couldn't have been done in the interim. Munich wouldn't work.
Yes. Couldn't have worked. But in Vienna, they knew exactly what he was bloody well talking about.
Well, of course they did, you see. Yeah. What I mean is that maybe you could say, because a lot of races came into conflict in Vienna, there's a greater degree of sensitiveness about it.
Yes.
But whatever it is, the anti-Semitism was acute. And it's the most anti-Semitic town in the world now. Remains.
Yes, as I think I tried to imply with what I was saying at the end, in that paragraph about these absolutely heartbreaking... No, the paragraph at the end is about these heartbreaking Jewish cemeteries.
Exactly.
Which make you weep to look at. And they're guarded by these bloody dogs. Mm. You know, night...
But only in Vienna. Yeah. And Salzburg, even more in Vienna.
Oh, really?
Acutely anti-Semitic town.
To which you returned with great pleasure again and again.
I don't mind anti-Semitism.
But how did you feel it in Salzburg?
Because
did
before
you feel
the war,
it kind of, did people make remarks?
Not in the least. Hmm. Nobody ever made a remark. It was kept by, I mean, it was organized by Jules Brent and lots of Jewish conductors. The Nazi symbol before the war was wearing long white stockings.
Yes.
Up to the knees. There were more white stockings in Salzburg
than anywhere else on earth.
I've seen. That's all I mean.
Yes.
I remember going to one of those restaurants, open ones, on the hill, not a Peter's Keller, but a Virgil Keller, something Keller. And there was a man there, and somebody said to the man, neighboring table to mine, "Was sind Sie denn eigentlich?" What are you? He said, "Kosmopolit, aber nicht Jude." At once, 1934.
Yes. How late did you go?
Not 34, no. I went till 37. 38, I'm sure, 39.
Yes.
Well, now they're in Germany. Yes. I could go to Austria. Mm. Afterwards, Fall Walter conducted it.
Yes.
Klemperer conducted.
Yes. My father was there in the summer of 37. Yes.
So, that was the last time.
Yes.
I went from 1930 onwards, every summer.
And when did you resume afterwards?
The center of my life in summer.
Hmm.
When I sat in trains going to Salzburg, I used to get in a state of physical excitement.
Yes.
The mere thought of being in this marvelous town.
Yes.
I adored it to such a degree.
Yes.
I never went alone, always had friends.
Where did you stay?
In Gasthofs.
Right.
Cheap Gasthofs, I mean, in sort of Gasthofs. Gardens outside, beer gardens.
Yeah.
Never in a hotel.
Yeah.
But we used to eat in the keller of the Österreicher Hof, which no longer exists, which is very cheap. Same food, upstairs at quarter of the price.
And did you meet friends again and again who would come the same?
Yes, not quite meet, even go with. I mean, yes, I went in 1930, I went with a man called Ettinghausen, who was a Jew at school with me, who then became the Israeli ambassador to Paris in due course, when he became a Zionist. I immediately met Don from Worcester and musical undergraduate from my college course.
Yeah.
It's quite easy. The Americans didn't go then.
Yes, but the English did.
English very much more than anyone else. Not more than Germans, but more than French, and more than what's all you could see. Very cheap too.
Yeah. What was the program of your day at Salzburg? I mean, what would you do? How would it go?
Reasonable question. I'd get up fairly late in the morning. I would then have breakfast, I suppose, downstairs. Shouldn't take a room. They might have brought it up to the room. If they did, just a sort of roll and butter and a cup of coffee, whatever it was. Then I would go for a walk with friends, and we would stay with them. We'd go somewhere and sit in a cafe, I suppose. Look at shop windows. Sit in a cafe and then sometimes the concerts in the morning. The marvelous concerts, 11 a.m., conducted by Walter in the Mozart Deo. The best Mozart concert I've ever had in my life, by far. But when they weren't, we would then go and stroll around the town, light the man up, and then meet for lunch in one of these kellers, either at the bottom of the hotel or in one of the hills. There was also a cheap hostel with beer serving. Pfannkuchen, omelettes, or pancakes, or sausages, or whatever. Goulash, whatever we might eat. Schnitzels. Then we would go back to the hostel, I think, and read a book, I suppose. From about 3 o'clock to about six. By that time, it's time to go to a cafe and eat a lot of food before the concert. An opera would run every night on it. It started at 7. It started earlier. And then went on to 11. Little long intervals. Then home. Home, they might stop on the way, have an ice cream or something. And that was day after day after day.
For how long? For a sort of, how long did it run in the 30s?
Like now. Every month. I'd never heard it so beautiful in all my life. I might have gone to Covent Garden maybe in the 20s, but I didn't.
Yeah.
Wasn't part of my life.
Yeah.
I thought it was the most marvelous experience. The tenor and the merit was marvelous. Willy Wolfgusto and Dom Graf Fassbender. And so on was the merit I got from the tenors. And the Reddish was. It's very beautiful 18th century opera. It is done. Then we went on to Salzburg. Figaro's Peon was experience of the most unbelievable kind. After that we had, as I say, the wonderful Barbara Seville done by the Scala outside.
With Walter conducting.
Very well. Then came Klemperer with the Beethoven symphonies. He accompanied. Finally, Toscanini.
Yeah.
He came 36. Now it's for 5 weeks. I wouldn't come there to begin. I would come in the second week and stay to the end. Fortnight at least. It was absolute bliss. Now, in the later years, I went to Stephen Spender, let us say, who didn't have
19 years before the war.
33.
Yeah.
And we went to Barbara Seville, which was not allowed in the Festspielhaus. They were only allowed Mozart and Strauss. Rossini and Valga. Walter conducted, marvelous people, the Scala sang it, divine. But it had to be in the Stadttheater. Couldn't be part, not part of the festival. There I met Osbert Lancaster and people I knew. And somebody, and Angus Malcolm was afterwards in the Foreign Office. One might meet anybody. In 1933, I went to Stephen Spender. He was had no money. And so he decided to eat some kind of food which would give him indigestion, in which case he wouldn't want to eat anything else, because he wouldn't spend money on food. But then he had Studentenfutter, student fodder. So some of it was squashed, horrible, decaying figs, figs, I don't know what, dates, I mean, which really might give him some disease. So he was quite steady. Then he discovered inside the pocket of his jacket was a £5 note. Sewn into it by his grandmother.
No.
He had certainly forgotten about it.
It's a very theatrical thing to discover.
He opened that. Now we could live more comfortably. £5. It was very, very cheap to have the English currency.
Oh, yeah.
That was all Reinhardt. That's then, you see. Yeah. We lived in a place called Leopoldskron, now American Seminoles.
Yeah.
Well,
Reinhardt kept the prices down, you mean?
No, they just were in Austria. Austrian currency was extremely inflated.
Yeah.
In terms of British currency,
yes,
also cheap. That's all I mean. I could always get money from England by writing on his bank if I was bad way, you see. But then, that's 34, 35. In 36, 34, I can tell you exactly who I went with. I went with Mary Fisher, daughter of the Warden of New College.
H.A.L.
H.A.L. Who was with our friend Miss Walker, with whom I had a brief run-in went over yet. I told you about
this.
She was there. Julia Packenham, who was sister of Lord Longford, who died for the war, we had friends. They were all there. Richard Percy, famous historian, a bit on his own, but associated with us.
Yeah.
He came with somebody. We had lots of people. Plenty of people to eat lunch and dinner with. There's no difficulty.
Yeah.
We went to Hallein, where there was a salt mine, who took a, sat on a leather belt and would rattle down to the earth, and underneath the earth was a salt kimp, with an underwater lake, salt water, then shot upstairs. There's plenty of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Hellbrunn, where there was
and
waterworks.
And
Hellbrunn was a princely palace, where you press the button and water spurted in the seats, a practical joke on the guests. that sort of thing. Right. So 17th century fun.
Right. Mm.
You would sort of press something and all against
sounds.
Still exists. Can be seen. Well,
did you go for walks in the Alps or in the walks? No, no, woods or things like
a bit. Not big walks.
You're not a rural case.
Yes, but not big walks. Went up the one or two of the hills immediately outside. Yeah. The rest
but I'm not to imagine you with a pack on your back and sturdy boots, striding ahead, singing.
Nobody did. That's 34, 5. 36, that's the people I've described to. Then John Foster appeared and with him I went to Venice, from Venice to Palestine, I've told you that.
Yes.
Straight from Salzburg.
Oh really, I didn't realize it.
To Alexandria.
Oh really?
Not to Palestine. That was 36. 34, sorry.
That must have been a marvelous journey by boat.
Yes, we went by boat from Venice. I went to Venice for 3 nights, and then I was late. And I didn't know, I was running, there's no time, I couldn't do anything else. Gondolas are very slow, to the hotel, to pack my, get my bag. Then I had to get to the boat, because he was leaving. And John Foster in the gondola shouted at him, and I didn't hear him. Suddenly I did see him, so I was able to stop. He had my luggage with him.
Right.
So I got straight to the gondola, from the shore, leapt into it, and onto the boat.
Yeah, yeah.
That was all right.
Yeah,
and then from Venice to Alexandria.
Direct.
We got over that.
Was it a kind of tremendously hot, boring voyage in a little tramp steamer?
No. Big luxury steamer boat.
All right.
12,000 tons.
Right.
That could be quite big. Yes. Not a tall boat, no. Quite all right. And a quite nice restaurant. We talked to a British planter.
You wear a nice white linen suit.
We talked to a planter. All right. From Egypt, and Foster talked to him, I talked to him. Kept on heading his head like this, didn't know where to look. Completely knocked down, I mean, talked down to us. God knows. And then on the boat was also...
Did you talk down to him about being a planter?
No. Just chatted.
The ball was whizzing so fast he couldn't...
anything. Then we arrived with a rich Jew on board, who tried to make friends with me. When he came, some pasha came to meet him, so I saw 34 Jews in here. Well, often.
Yeah.
He's under no nonsense, I mean, kissed and so on. Then a lot of men appeared in long, coloured, sort of bath gowns. I mean, these were sort of Egyptian, God knows what, agents.
Yeah.
Seized our luggage. They looked like sort of British caricatures of natives. They seized us in punch, some number of punch.
Yeah.
They seized my luggage and said, I'm not Porter, I'm agent for Porter. Give me money. And the agent for Porter would take it to the Porter, would take more money. Well, we got to the hotel in Alexandria. Then we went to Cairo, and we looked at Alexandria, we looked at the pyramids, and then we got onto a train which took us to Jerusalem, across
direct.
The... Well, we had to get off to onto the ferry, over the...
Yes, the sea.
The sea, as you see. And that was romantic beyond belief, the ferry. A lot of Arabs and a lot of sheep, and the goats, camel on to night. The eyes of these animals glittering, total darkness, discordant cries. There really was no little scene. Then I got to a train in Kantara East, from Kantara West.
This is late summer, midsummer. This is August 34?
This is September. The festival comes to an end.
Yes.
And August. And then we got to this train, and then suddenly we went through Sinai and all that, which is frightfully exciting. Look out the window, 5 a.m, dawn, across these marvelous hills, you see, extraordinary desert, with a sort of rising desert covering, sort of terrific scenery, the Negev and Sinai, a dramatic kind. And then a Jewish ticket collector came in. It's the first time I'd seen Jew in uniform anywhere.
Yeah.
I was really moved by that.
Yeah.
And when we began to reach the borders of Palestine, tears came from my eyes. John Foster couldn't understand. He was tremendously moved, sentimentally moved.
Yeah.
The thought that this was a Jewish country. Still British, but still.
Yeah.
There was a specific Jewish settlement. And there were British officials, British ticket collectors, British policemen. Wonderful. You see? I was moved exactly as all Jews were moved in later years.
Yeah.
It happened to me rather early. Yeah. From there we went to King David Hotel. It was a fine hotel built by a horrible Goldsmith's father, mm-hmm. Frank Goldsmith, mm-hmm. the Jimmy Goldsmith's father,
yeah.
was doing the hotels, and there were these Nubians, jet black, with enormous, great trailing gowns serving them as waiters. I remember the jet black. And at the British Hotel, yeah. and that's when the, more as the British officials would gather at the bar. In the evenings, I went to see my aunt, who was already living. She was there with Zionist uncle. She said, you mustn't go to the hotel, that's said to be anti-Semitic. I said, no, mind. I didn't mind about that. And then I tell you the story, my arrival in Palestine. Did I never?
No, you've told me, you've told it to me in a different way.
With police sports.
No.
First thing John Foster and I did, he knew some officials. I didn't. We came as pure tourists. I knew nobody there. I didn't mean to visit Zionist notables, because I didn't know it. I said, I wasn't an official Zionist or anything else. Down at Oxford with certain convictions. They had no contact with the official movement in any way.
Yeah.
We,
he knew something. You're still in your 20s anyway.
Yes, 35. And so we went to see, we were invited to go to the police sports in Nablus.
In where?
Nablus.
Oh, in Nablus.
We went, we sat there, police sports occurred, boring beyond belief. Kind of Gymkhana, I mean, people on motorbicycles or people in cars whizzing past. I sat next to a man wearing short trousers, who was a British official. And I said to him, we're looking on two hills. I said, I think they must be the biblical, Ebal and Gerizim. Now I knew Samaritans live there and they bring a Paschal lamb as a sacrifice at their Passover, the Bible of the Road, and a high priest.
Yes.
And I said, which is Ebal Gerizim? He said, I don't know. Just hills to me. No one asked me that kind of question. He later became Lord Carradon.
Oh, really?
Yes. He was called Hugh Foote.
Oh, yes, Hugh Foote.
He was in Palestine.
Yes.
The district commissioner.
Oh, really?
Came tremendous prayer, but took an interest in
went
to Cyprus, governor of Cyprus, and
from
all that, you see.
And father of Paul Foote, in fact.
Father of Paul Foote. And I met him afterwards with Brian Urquhart in New York. Yes. And I reminded him, he was not best pleased.
Yes.
He was a very, quite sort of crude, uninteresting, sort of awful man. I didn't like him at all then. I had no idea who he was.
Yeah. Did you like him better later?
No, at no point. Yeah. At no point. I thought he was a self-important, gooey, religious, idealistic, sort of liberal, of the most, so to speak,
awful
beings. I mean, sort of, Jews and Arabs ought to meet, they ought to be with each other and so on. I don't know, a lot of preaching of a sort of gooey kind. I couldn't bear it. I could say he's not a bad fellow. Me, didn't think he was a bad fellow. But he was a British ambassador at that time to the United Nations.
Yes.
That's the time. So I couldn't bear him. Didn't like the brothers either. Michael Foote, I can just take. That's something silly about him.
Yes.
Silly and disarming.
Yes.
But Lord Carradon was awful. Lord Foote, the solicitor, pretty awful. Dingle Foote, pretty awful. All the brothers.
Yes.
No sisters. Yes. Father was probably, I wonder if Isaac Foote. Maybe somebody. Anyway, well then, police sports. Then I went back to Jerusalem, and then I met the director of education, who was a man called Berman, who was a raging anti-Semite, straightforwardly. I got the dough.
Really?
Yes.
How did you sense it? I mean,
because he said the Jews are dreadful, yeah. I don't know if you know them at all. You come from England, I don't suppose. You have come across people like that. And so you see, I didn't find the nationalistic, the dishonest, the crooks, the violent, the hate the native, we can't manage them at all. And he passed out.
Okay.
His assistant was a man called Khalidi, who was the father of Khalidi.
Really?
He was a flattering, cheap, vulgar man, one of the worst men, worst Arab I ever met, who sucked up to the British in the most...
Shameless way.
Well, you see, they would say, who've been to Syria? Oh, well, it's a police state. Oh, dreadful. French. Oh, just tyrannical. Oh, they crush British show. Quite a different show, yeah. Prose, sort of way. You see what I mean?
Yes.
Oh, well, oh, no, no, no. We're quite happy with you. Oh, you've noticed, maybe. Well, I mean, you don't do trouble with people. Oh, no. Oh, God, no comparison. And so on. I thought it was terrible. Yeah. Well, then, I was some, my aunt is in Jews and you. But then finally, I did go and see, I went to university, where I knew one or two, vaguely I called it somebody. Michael Barnett was a very nice German Jew, librarian, extremely learned orientalist, very, very honorable, dull, totally decent guy.
Yeah.
Was a scholar in Berlin. And he said, no, you must come this evening to see Mr. Shmari Levine. Shmari Levine is a very amusing man, who wrote the best book on Zionism written by anybody, called Out of Bondage, Three Volumes.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Russian, sort of semi-rabbi. He was Weizmann's only friend. He was very comical, full of humor, and I thought wonderful, and had no illusions about what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
He said to me, that he said to everybody, the Jews are a very small nation, but a terrible one. Or disgusting, something like that. They're tiny, but they're dreadful. I really enjoyed that.
Right.
Well, then at his house, I met Scholem, the famous.
He's
very young, lively, but slightly mad, dashed about, obviously wanted attention to a painting. So I'm still glad to meet him. He's always gifted and romantic and interesting as a man. Then we had attached to us as tourists, some Zionist propagandist, bored us to tears. He took us to kibbutzes, he took us to, and all, we did stuff.
Yeah.
The colonists, they were all right. When I had lunch with them, the people in the kibbutz were wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Individually wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
They were simple, they were communist, they gave us nice good food, they were modest,
mm-hmm.
they were sweet. Those people in 34 really were wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
It's all gone.
Yes.
East, west, whatever you call it.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, they were very touching characters. Everybody found them that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then I met a lady, I can go on like this. I met a lady, some odd characters you could meet. There was a lady called Manya Vilbushevich. She was called Manya Shochat. She married a man called Shochat. She came from Odessa. She was a Russian revolutionary. She took very vigorous part in the terrorist section of the Russian Socialist Revolutionary Party. She made friends with the chief of police, who
in Odessa,
you remember, there was a movement started by a man called Zubatov. Zubatov was the chief police in Odessa. He thought he could create a party of the left and the monarchists against the bourgeoisie.
Mm.
Populist party, the workers and the peasants and the little father, you see?
Yes.
Who had against horrible, exploiting, liberal factory owners.
Yes. Anything like Gappen?
Gappen was a member of that movement.
Mm.
And that's why Gappen was killed in the end. Because
mm.
he called the police by. Gappen was their man in the end.
Mm.
That's why he was accused of being a traitor.
Mm.
But she worked with Zubatov. And when Zubatov was showing up, Zubatov had to resign. After the Bloody Sunday, So he was sacked.
Mm.
He was pronounced a failure. She escaped and went to Palestine immediately.
Incredible.
Exactly. And became a colonist. Now when Weizmann came, 1911, 12, she led him around the place. They became tremendous friends. I met her in 34, an old lady living in a place called Kfar Giladi in the northern colony,
yeah.
The edges of Lebanon.
Yeah.
Tough, old, and passive. Real Russian revolutionary. Of a sort of gnarled, absolutely seasoned, weathered kind.
Yeah,
and I knew who she was.
Yeah, yeah.
You see?
Yeah,
so it was rather interesting to talk to.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
come back on her illusions?
I said, I want to pay for this meal. And pay for this meal, she said. There is such a thing as being overgenerous, there's such a thing as being over mean. Overgenerosity also won't do. She said, that's a sin.
That's a good remark.
Mm-hmm. But I was glad to meet her. Then when I met various people, from various kinds of, and then we went to, after that, I got this impression of the country, as I told you. I felt very strongly, it's exactly like Passage to India. You see, it was like, you see, the British officials were by and large anti-Jew. Partly for real reasons. They were the least gifted of all the colonial office officials, because it was the least smart place to go to. If you were any good, you went to Sudan, India, Nairobi. Palestine, the protectorate, was not the smartest place colonial office governed. Even Cyprus was a bit superior. So they were simple folk. They were not nasty. They were idealistic. They wanted to help the natives, native Arabs. They arrived in the place. The fundamental pattern which the British create wherever they went is that the English public school. That's what the embassy was like in Washington, equally. Now, here were the boys, they were Arabs. There was a Jewish house. We didn't really need it, but in these days, couldn't be avoided. The boys of the Arabs, they occasionally let off steam, killed a few people. Riots in Hebron in 29, which is a very bloody pogrom to this day. Well, all right, boys were the boys. They have to be punished. The Jews were pasty-faced, cleverer than the masters, didn't play games, cheated, deceived, did circles around the masters, and wanted everything. So it was their country. Didn't see why the Arabs should be there at all. Moreover, there were these British officials that thought they were either black or white, difference of treatment.
Yes, and these were sort of neither.
Ooh. Pavlov dogs. They tried to bark and salivate at the same time. Impossible to make out. Jews mingled with the white.
Yes.
Jews from Bukhara were obviously black.
Yes.
But between that, what did you do with Jews from cut your ear. If you kicked a Jew Arab down the stairs, Sir Ronald Stalls, governor of Jerusalem, kicked him, that's the last you heard of it. If you kicked a Jew, or tried to, and anything might happen. The boys would write their parents in America, maybe, or to England. Or in America, their parents would know somebody who knew Mr. Justice Brandeis. Mr. Justice Brandeis would write to the, I don't know, American ambassador, who would write the colonial office.
And you'd never hear the end of it.
Complaining of the parents, complaining to governors. Nothing schoolmasters like this. Ghastly nuisance. You couldn't tell. A dirty little Jew suddenly turns out to have connections. It made it even worse. The hatred grew. It was perfectly normal, but that was the atmosphere. The only people who were pro-Jewish, there were some among the officials whom I met, were rather tired. Some said Mormish, cynical officials who really didn't believe in the Balfour Declaration or the Jews, or they were just bored. So it was an awful place. Difficult situation, and the Jews were more amused.
Yeah.
They had no idealism or colonial office loyalty at all. They were just living out their lives.
Yeah.
They wanted to enjoy themselves.
Yeah.
These people preferred the company of amusing Jews. There were some Jews who got on with the sort of Council Irish, who got on with the High Commissioner. They were regarded as traitors by the Jews I met.
Oh, really?
Well, the great Zionist Harry Sacker, the lawyer, was there. But he was an English Jew from Manchester, a journalist, Manchester Guardian. He was a very tough lawyer, he was 1,000% Zionist. But the Russian Jews, Polish Jews, all those Jews looked on him as some kind of alien. He's the High Commissioner, goes to dinner.
Not one
of us.
Yeah.
So that was painful. The Jews thought they were going to be presented by the British with a Balfour Declaration, instead of which they found they were blocked at every turn. The Arabs were protected. And they preferred the Arabs for obvious reasons. They were nicer, they were easier to get governed. They only knew how to be governed by the Turks. So they just applied the same techniques, had more charm, were better looking. There was a hideous language, very unattractive, noisy, tasteless. Imagine East Side Jews being in the face of a lot of minor public school. English officials. Imagine this.
Yeah.
High commissioners broadly are much better with the Jews than, particularly the generals.
Than the lower?
Than the lower, well, Chancellor of the West, that's from that point of view. He is the grandfather of my friend who married, what's his name? John Wells.
Oh, yes.
His daughter, his wife.
Oh.
The granddaughter of High Commissioner. Oh. Under whom the Wailing Woman riots broke out.
Oh, really?
In 1931, that happened. He was very anti-Semitic. But broadly, if you're a British official, the liability was you as a kind of club, upper class anti-Semitism, which you could feel.
Yeah.
Except, I say, for these rather exhausted,
cynical
legs.
How long were you in Palestine?
A month. Then I went to Jordan. Went to Jordan.
To the Hashemites.
What?
To the Hashemites.
Well, wait. The man I knew in Jerusalem, I forgot to tell you, was a man called Tommy Hodgkin. Tommy Hodgkin was the son of the Adonant Queens, who became prophet of Queens in Oxford. He was a very idealistic Wiccanist, my contemporary, came from Balliol College. He was secretary of the High Commissioner. He was a man called General Walker. He was a member of the Communist Party. I didn't know that. Not a day. Crypto. I knew quite well. He was violently anti-Jewish, from a purely left-wing point of view.
Yeah.
Natives.
Not an anti-Semite, but just
anti-Jew. He thought not, but he was really, I think, a bit. But I think he would have denied it with ferocious. I stayed with him in the Austrian hospice. We were living. We went on backs of mules, and when we came in, donkeys, when we came back to Jerusalem, it was Friday afternoon, and we were stoned by the pious Jews.
Oh, really?
Just like Christ. Come, Hosanna. Came riding in a donkey. I remember that. Well, Tommy Hodgkin was very, was of course, discovered and sacked in the end.
Yeah.
He had a wonderful time in his prayer. It was when he was in London, there was an Arab delegation, which he organized and led in 1937. There was a bus strike. And he explained to them what it was. He said, why aren't they shot? He was a communist.
Yeah.
Bus striker. Shoot them, said his Arab delegation. It was very difficult to reconcile Arab nationalism with British communism.
Indeed.
Anyway.
The sight of you entering
we all went to Amman together. Exactly.
It's a sight I would pay good money
to see. Sure, yes. We all went to Amman. We all got beds, Hashemites. We all got beds except me. I stood looking at the ruins of Jerash for too long, and I slept on a stone inscription which said the emperor, I think Trajan, maybe Hadrian, visited suddenly. And every letter absolutely carved itself to my back during the night.
Yeah.
Then we went, I met a nephew of the Abdallah, who was extremely nice to me, said, Jews and Arabs are brothers, all that, and so on, all that. We're all Semites, it's wonderful. Then we went to Syria, went to Damascus, and then saw the Umayyad Mosque, 34.
Yeah.
And the Umayyad Mosque, which is one of the most beautiful mosques I've ever seen in my life. I love mosques. I much prefer the churches.
Really?
Wonderful, yeah. Empty and beautiful.
Yes, it's the emptiness.
And then to Lebanon. In Lebanon we stayed at a place called Aleh, which is above Beirut, which was a suburb. He's there, Aleem.
I know.
How do you know? Then I remembered Aleh, the Day of Atonement. In Aleh. I suddenly discovered eminent Israelis concealing themselves in Aleh when they didn't need to starve.
Oh, really?
That's quite funny.
Yeah.
One of the justices Supreme Court.
Was just hiding out.
Hiding out, that's funny. I looked at Beirut. The road, motor road from Beirut to Haifa. Most beautiful in the world, drunk and then go down. With them, you know, with the anti-Lebanon on the left, Hermon, with snow on top. And this marvelous Mediterranean side of Saida and Sur, in other words, Sidon and Tyre, on the your right.
I know exactly what you mean, because I've stood up in a fortified kibbutz right up on the border and looked down, and you can see the coast, and it is ravishing.
Exquisite. And then you see
and every single village is filled with gunmen, so there's nowhere you can.
But let me tell you, little ships with red leather sails,
yeah,
looking like Delacroix painting.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
The beautiful sight I ever saw. Real romantic 19th century stuff. Well, we arrived in Haifa. At that point, then I went back to Jerusalem for a few days, I don't know why. At that point, John Foster left with my companion. He had business in Palestine, never mind. It's to do with the Ottoman Zayas case, which is well, it's a joke. When the heirs of the last Sultan maintained that while the territories of the next parts of Turkey were politically what they were, the great tracts of the territory were the private fief of the Sultan, that would belong to them legally.
As personal property.
As personal property. And they persuaded rich American ladies to finance the lawsuits against at least two governments, the British and the French, who were the protectorates of the place. So that when they got their property back, they'd be billionaires. Yeah. They'd pay them, give them lots of the money. They were financed. This went from court to court to court to court, Privy Council. Yeah. You know, right in the way it went to in France. But they had British defended at every point. From the point of lawyers,
it was paradise.
John Foster was instructed by the Treasury to see some Armenian lawyer in Haifa and use that as an excuse for going.
Oh, yeah.
When he did his business, which was half an hour, he went home. I was left behind. Oh. That's when I met Stern, I told you that. At that point, I got onto a boat to go back to Europe. Lloyd Tristino boat called the Gerusalemme, which went from Haifa to Trieste. I was alone, second class. There were two restaurants on the boat. One was kosher, the other was not. I'm not an addicted kosher eater, as you know, but that's what was second class Italian boat. I'll fall ill if I eat Italian salami and God knows, rotting food. Kosher is very boring, but it's absolutely clean.
Yeah.
It's washed, it's salted.
Yeah.
That's much more likely to be digestible. Anyway, I'm used to it. My mother's house. So I went to the Persian part, I sat at the table, along the long benches, and next to me was a young man, deep sunken eyes, rather handsome. No, he was. I said, my name is Isaiah Berlin, I come from Oxford. He said, my name is Abraham Stern, I'm a student of Latin and Greek, University of Florence. Mussolini gave scholarships to Israelis as an anti-British move. In Italian universities, for free, I think. The Arabs didn't take it up very much. Jews, of course, did. This was a man who went to Florence, a classical scholar. This was the Stern. And then we chatted about this and that. I thought he was an interesting man, quite. And he said, you know that what the British want to do. They want to create a thing called the Legislative Council. We shall fight that and fight it and fight it. I said, but look, why? Well, because they're arithmetically determined. 84 Arabs and 27 Jews, I counted that. So I said, but it's only advisory. He says, no, never mind. We shall fight and fight and fight. And if blood is to be shed, it'll be shed. Then I realized I'm fanatic. And I tried to persuade him not to shed blood unsuccessfully. He had a sort of follower with him who nodded and didn't talk very much. He was quite the interesting man. As I say, poet.
Oh, that handsome. Is surprising, I didn't
know. Oh, he was all that. Well, the letters he wrote to his mother, apparently I didn't read them, very moving from jail.
Mm.
But
when did he actually organize the gang?
He organized the gang as a breakaway from the Irgun. The breakaway being on the grounds that they might make peace with the Germans and fight the British. They are Arab members,
yeah,
Stern gang.
Mm. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, the Palestinian nation. Mm. They broke away probably in about 1939, 38 maybe. I don't know when the Irgun was created, before Begin, Kotta. Jabotinsky
Yes.
Created, and yes. He was a member of that. Then he created this breakaway, another mad group, with Shamir.
Yeah.
All these people, to a terrorist group which didn't, the Irgun wanted to fight the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
He did not.
Yeah.
That was the main part of the difference. Yeah. He thought they could. The great thing was to get the British out. Never mind.
How?
Oh, yeah. Lunatic they were. That's all that they were. Now, after that I came back to Trieste and back to Oxford. After that, another 34. We took over Salzburg. Back to Salzburg. 36, 37. 36 I went with, I don't know, a lot of, with Stuart Hampshire. I called Francis Graham Harrison, was after the Home Office civil servant, who was an attorney at Oxford.
Does your friendship with Stuart Hampshire date to that?
Dates a little earlier. I met him at Oxford as an undergraduate, I would say in the early 35.
What struck you about him?
Extreme intelligence and charm. He lived in a house where I knew all the inhabitants, number 7 Bremont Street, with a highbrow center consisting of. Hello? Yes. She's there, but she's being done. Her hair's being done. Well, look, now it's. What is the time now? The time now is.
5 to 4.
Look, why don't you telephone her at 4:15, 4:15? She'll be here. Or she can ring you. Are you in your office? I'll tell her. Right? And,
we're talking about Stuart Hampshire.
Well, the house at 7 Bremont Street consisted of Ben Nicholson, the son of Harold, was after the historian. His friend, Jeremy Hutchinson, now Lord Hutchinson of Lullington, who was a lawyer, and the mother labor is a SDP of the House of Lords, married to various wives, Peggy Ashcroft and others. David Wallace, son of a Tory minister called Ewan Wallace, who was a cabinet minister under Chamberlain, who was a crypto-communist, not exactly known to be, was killed in during the war in Greece, and Stuart Hampshire. And they were a kind of highbrow center.
Yeah.
And used to ask, I was a Don, I didn't become one in 32, so this was 3 years later. Don's as young as me, new undergraduates of that sort. Easy va-vient between us. So I used to be asked to parties by them.
What is the age difference between you and Stuart?
4 years. No, not more. I came up, I'm 78, eh? He came up in 33.
Mm-hmm.
5 years old, he'd be 75.
Yeah.
74 maybe.
Yeah.
I think he was born 1915.
Mm-hmm.
What would he be? 73.
Yeah.
74.
Yes.
74 you would be.
Yeah.
That's the age difference. Maybe 6 years.
Yeah.
5, 6 years.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's quite easy. Because I became a non-sense too. These are bright undergraduates 3 years later. And one thing, I met with classes, I mean, I held a class with Austin, all these people turned up, we used to talk philosophy. Often I was asked to meals by these young men, because the highbrow dons, where I was one, were cultivated by them, as they always are, particularly young ones.
Yeah.
I made friends with a lot.
Yeah.
But Stuart, I thought, was particularly interesting and intelligent.
Mm.
We became lifelong friends from then on.
Mm.
Then he was elected All Souls in 36. You see?
Right.
But in 36 years old, I went around Ireland with him and a man called Con O'Neill, now dead, was a Foreign Office official who got England the common market.
Mm-hmm.
Son of the Speaker of the Ulster Parliament, a man called Lord O'Neill, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
This is my sort of ordinary Oxford life. And then, let me see what happened after that. In 36, all these people were there. I'm sure there.
Yeah.
And Graham Harrison was there. And,
do you remember?
My friend Jasper Ridley was killed in the war. The daughter of the Violet Bonham Carter, all these Asquith characters were there.
And did you spend most of your time with
fellow
English?
With the gang.
You didn't form German or Austrian?
No. I met nobody.
Hmm.
With the gang. Just went to concerts. And so he talked.
Did you talk politics? Did you sense the clouds of war gathering over your
head?
All that kind of portentous stuff.
1930, when was it, 32, Garon Veritz, my friend, from Moselle's, came off a plane from Berlin and said, what's the situation? Politically, we talked about it. Mm. Oh, yes, we were very well aware. What's going on? Vyshushnik, you see, was the first, what's his name?
Chancellor.
The Chancellor, who was the first one? Called Millimetternich, tiny little man.
Dollfuss.
First Dollfuss, then Vyshushnik. Oh, it was obvious that things were going bad towards. There'd been the assassination of Dollfuss in 1934.
Yeah.
My parents persuaded me not to go to Salzburg, but I went.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the music. Can you cast your mind back to those concerts?
They were divine.
To the things, to the concerts, or the musical experiences that you remember best from that time?
I can. The Mozart symphonies, conducted by Walter, were ne plus ultra, best I ever heard, by anyone. Better than Beecham, certainly better than my god, Toscanini. They were done in Mozarteum and in the Festspiel House.
What was it about them that, still strikes you
the
as being so fine?
The lyrical poetical quality. The lyricism, the extraordinary velvety quality. Maybe one doesn't like that, not everybody likes it in Mozart. The silken quality. And the wonderful nuances, which were exquisitely done. So that every time one heard a thing done by Walter, one learned something new. So he was a very gentle, extremely lyrical, mild, he was no good at Beethoven, for that reason. It was Mozart.
But wonderful for Mozart.
Mozart, Schubert, Mahler. Mm. It was all right.
Mahler as well.
He was a disciple, pupil of Mahler. Pupil. You see, in Klemperer of Beethoven. Mm. Very different thoughts. Well, then in museum. That was one thing. Operas. The performances of Figaro, first performance of Figaro I heard, was in Munich in, Don Giovanni, Munich in 1932, conducted in the Munich Opera by a man called Leo Blech, was an excellent conductor. I was absolutely overcome.